Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here, 10 minutes after 12 on this Wednesday afternoon, and we are starting the show in a bit of a subdued fashion because, well, it's just been subdued, and I'm looking at the price of oil right now, and it's dropped a few cents since I sat down, now at $30.16 a barrel. John Najarian from CNBC and at Option Monster on Twitter is on a phone line with us. John, welcome to the Midday Business Lunch.
Great to be back with you. Thank you, Steve.
Is it great to be anywhere? And I'm reading this report from the Royal Bank of Scotland, this analyst, Andrew Roberts, and you're probably familiar with it, but they're warning of a cataclysmic year. Quote, sell everything except high-quality bonds. And another quote, we think investors should be afraid. Are those your sentiments?
First of all, I think that they're right about investors being afraid. I don't know if they should be or not, but they certainly have been for the first trading week of the new year, which began pretty miserably last week, and hasn't really got a lot better as we moved into this week. We've seen rallies vaporize every time they've tried to hold their heads up. The market has been smacked. Now, today is a slight exception because even though we're negative, it's only slightly today. But as you know, Steve, the market was substantially higher early on.
Well, what happened there? It jumped up. It was up almost 200 points, the Dow was.
Yeah, and then crude oil rolled over. And the primary focus of a lot of folks right now is, when does crude oil finally bottom? Today it's down another 4%. And if I looked at a chart of crude oil, it was up until about almost 9 o'clock this morning. And as soon as it broke that line, let's call it at about 31.50, and now it's trading $30.13, down 4%, the market rolled over with it, giving up those gains. European markets stayed higher. The FTSE was up 1%, German and French markets up about 1.7%. Not at their absolute highs, but still, they held on to the bulk of their gains, even as we gave ours back. So that's thin gruel, as they say, Stephen, but I'm watching that because this tells me it's more about some of the reactions to crude oil in the very short term than it is about negative market implications for weeks or months.
Well, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, they all say they see oil bursting below 30, which, I mean, we're almost there today, and down closer to 20. Do you think it's going to get that bad?
I didn't think it would get that bad, and I could still be surprised. I know Dennis Gartman, who's both a friend of mine and an active market commentator, he believes that we could see within the next 2 or 3 days, he told me yesterday, a whoosh lower out of crude oil that would spook out and finally flush out the weakest hands that are still in that particular commodity, and then that we'd pop right back up to about 32, where we would stay for months and months. This is his opinion. It does make sense that we'd see some sort of a V-shaped bottom when we do finally flush, because that's how markets normally do clear. You need some sort of cathartic event like that. And long term, there's just no way, Stephen, that this is bad for the United States. It's not bad for India. It's not bad for Europe, the price of crude oil and energy going down like this. However, in the very short term, the market is not happy about it because it implies a whole bunch of risk scenarios for some over-leveraged companies in that particular space.
Well, I was just going to say this is a case of be careful what you wished for because it's not so good for us. But you're saying long-term, this is not going to be a bad thing for us in general.
No. The only bad thing in my mind, Stephen, about energy prices this low is it means you're not going to see the same amount of dollars spent on the sort of things Elon Musk does. That is, you're not going to see solar and or batteries take over to the same extent, because with crude oil down at $30 a barrel, and if we stay down here for months and months, we're going to eventually see $1.50 for gasoline. There's just no incentive for people to invest dramatic amounts of money in those emerging technologies, and that could be a longer-term negative. But again, not so much for the market as for the environment and or, you know, for particular people that are driven by how the energy patch works.
It's always so funny to me. I mean, I can understand someone if you're 18 or 21 years old and the gas price plummets and then you decide you're going to buy a guzzler. But if you're older than that, I mean, I'm not foolish enough to think that the gas prices aren't one day going to be back around $3 or $4 a gallon. Is that wrong for me to think that?
No, I think you're right. I don't know how long it will be, but I'll tell you one of the things that is why you're a smart guy, Steve, and that is we already could, and we do, export refined product out of the United States. Up until recently, though, it was illegal to export the unrefined crude oil product itself. Now, what that means is that even though oil prices are substantially lower than where they were last year at this time, or even 6 months ago, the price at the pump last year, I was gassing up in the wintertime at around $2 a gallon up in Wisconsin when I'd go up skiing, and it's still right at that same level now, even though crude is so much lower. That's because, of course, they're exporting gasoline as fast as they can make it because they have such an edge, such a profit margin in that refined product. But again, that didn't change from last year to this year. They could have exported gasoline last year as well. But obviously, if you can export it to the Caribbean nations or even overseas, you're getting a substantial premium to what you'd be getting here. So you're taking some of the supply off the market, which is why our price is not falling as fast as it otherwise would.
That's John. I'm sorry. That's John Najeri. Now, I want to get a stock tip from you, but very quickly, one government report out today, U.S. employers advertised slightly more jobs in November, a sign that overall hiring edged up and more Americans are quitting their jobs in sign of a healthier environment for workers. So that's an encouraging note, is it not?
There are a number of those. And, you know, I'm sure the president tonight at the State of the Union address will cite numerous parts of the economy that are showing positive signs. Nonetheless, there are, because of Dodd-Frank and a host of other measures that have been passed since the financial crisis, there's been a real impediment to jobs at the level that people had been working, and now they're having to work multiple jobs to basically take home the same amount of money. So it's not half full or half empty. It just depends which side you're on, Steve.
It's just half.
How good things have been. Yes, sir.
All right. Well, real quick then, what's your stock tip for today?
All right. We like Host Marriott. That's HST, Host Hotels. Not Host Marriott, I shouldn't say, because they broke away from that, but just Host Hotels, HST. We see a lot of longer-term buyers in there right now, and so we bought that for clients. And, of course, everybody remembers that just recently we saw Starwood merge with the Marriott Corporation, and now we see another hotel chain seeing upside speculation that maybe something's going on with them.
John Najarian, thanks very much. It was nice to talk to you today.
Always, Stephen. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. It's 12:21. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Andrew Herman is here from DNA Info Chicago talking about openings and closings. Andrew, welcome into the studio.
Hey, Steve.
You braved it. Not too bad out there.
Oh, it's lovely out.
A lot of snow blowing around and all of that stuff.
Well, at least it's sunny.
At least it's
you can
sunny,
pretend
right.
It's warm.
So the sun then blinds you when the snow blows right in front of your face. So, yeah, all of that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple of things. We talk about openings and closings, and we'll start on the down note. There were just hoes and rats when Oprah moved into the Near West Side.
Exactly. That's what she says.
That was a quote from her. And then, so one of the last signs of Harpo Studios went away.
Yeah, last week they removed the signs from the big studio over there, 1058 West Washington, in the West Loop, I guess you could call it. I don't even think they used to call it the West Loop before she got there, right?
No, they used to call it Beyond the Expressway.
Right. On the way to the stadium neighborhood. But as you point out, and as she has noted, that it was really a terrible rundown neighborhood before she bought this old building on the Near West Side there. And that was back in 88. And she, late last year, sold the building because obviously she has left town on us. out in Southern California. She sold the building in actually 2014 for $32 million to a developer, Sterling Bay. And we're still not sure what Sterling Bay is going to do with it, though. It's likely to be demolished, and there have been some renderings floating around out there. It shows a seven-story office and office building with some retail on the first floor. So this building, which was kind of a historic building even before Oprah.
Was it a cold storage or a morgue or what was it?
Yeah, it was a cold storage building, but it was used to keep bodies after the Eastland disaster when when the ship tipped over in the Chicago River years ago and all those people died, which she always said there were ghosts in the building. But so time marches on, and I think she leaves in her wake a much healthier economically speaking anyway, neighborhood, lots of restaurants.
Does she get credit for some of that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The aldermen and the Chamber of Commerce people here in Chicago say absolutely. She started it. And though I do think that maybe the rebuilding of the United Center probably helped push things along too.
It is remarkable, isn't it? Because we're both old enough to know when, I mean, there was just a stretch there from the loop out to the stadium. Mm-hmm. What wasn't always...
It was like Skid Row.
You weren't going to walk it, right?
Yeah,
it
was now Skid people Row. Can't That's afford to live there.
It was called Skid Row. Yeah. And you're right. Now people can't afford to live there. Yeah. All right, so let's go to Wicker Park because I like this story a lot. Pork and Mindy's.
Pork and Mindy's.
Is a sandwich shop that opened up. And one of the guys behind it, behind the food part of it anyway, won one of these reality TV shows, right? The Sandwich King?
Yes, Jeff Morrow. He's a local guy. He's on the Food Network. He's from Elmwood Park, and a few years ago he won one of these food competition shows and sort of made a name for himself as the Sandwich King. And he has now opened a sandwich shop in Wicker Park, 1623 North Milwaukee. They're describing it as fast casual. It has seven different kinds of unique sandwiches, including something called the Pig Candy BLT.
Right. Who could go wrong with something called the Pig Candy BLT?
That's a smoked bacon with brown sugar.
Well, what I like about this story is, and I might be completely wrong. I could be absolutely wrong. But it seems to me that chains in this country start with a solitary spot, and then it goes well, and then they expand. Right?
Right.
And that's kind of... These guys, well, they're starting with a single spot. They're already planning to expand in the spring, but they're already looking big time, right? They want to be across the country.
It probably comes from this guy's national standing, right? He's
sure.
thinking, I'm not going to spend all my time just running one sandwich shop in Chicago and Wicker Park. And as you point out, they're already going to open one in Irving Park in the spring on Irving Park Road. But their plan is to go national. And beyond the fact that he's well known as the Sandwich King, people watch him on television, he makes these sandwiches, they also have an idea in which they're going to try to use their sandwich shops as local art galleries.
I love this.
Yeah. So on the walls, if you go into a Pork and Mindy's, you'll see work by local artists, and you can buy it. You can buy the artwork.
I guess there are a lot of restaurants that will have things on the wall, but so their idea is they're going to have one permanent piece of art on one wall and then rotate on others.
Yeah, they'll have just all kinds of works, and they're going to have local musicians play occasionally. Not every day like, Potbelly, you see the guy playing the guitar all the time in Potbelly. But,
right. Until the quarter runs out and then he falls down.
Yeah, so they have big plans. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But sandwiches, that's a growth market, I would think,
I think
right?
So. And, look at there. You can buy gourmet burgers or upscale burgers just about everywhere now, so why not just a regular sandwich joint?
And how can you forget the name? If you were alive in the 70s and watched Mork and Mindy, you'll remember Pork and Mindy's.
It's hard to say. We stutter every time, don't you? Pork and Mindy's.
Yeah.
It's in Wicker Park on Milwaukee Avenue.
Right.
Andrew Herman, nice to see you.
Okay.
You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. When we come back, let's see, on the other side of the news, we're going to talk to an economics professor from Northwestern University, sort of get... Well, I don't know if we'll get a preview of the State of the Union or maybe a review of the Obama administration, because it sounds like the talk tonight is going to be a lot about the last 7 years and maybe not so much about the next one. That's coming up right now. Break here on 720 WGN. 12:37 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Wednesday afternoon. President Obama delivers his final State of the Union address tonight. It's being described by some as more of a breakup letter than a call to action. President likely will look back at what he's accomplished rather than call for any bold new initiatives in this, the final year of his presidency. Matt Notowadigdo is an associate professor of economics at Northwestern University. He joins us now on a phone line for a preview of tonight's events. Professor, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. Now, so as I think of last year's State of the Union address, I recall him calling for a higher minimum wage, free community college across the country, and increased paid sick leave for workers in the United States, and I don't recall that any of that actually happened in the past year.
Yeah, I think that's right. There was a lot of talk, but not a lot of action. I don't think any of those policies have really gone anywhere, although on the last one, on paid sick leave, it's something that candidates on both the political parties are starting to talk about in the current election.
But do State of the Union sort of initiatives, the things that presidents bring forward, do they usually bear fruit, or is it pretty rare that they do?
That's a good question. I read an article the other day that most of Obama's policies haven't been led to action for most of his administration. I think of it as trying to set the terms of discussion rather than trying to work on passing specific policies.
And the president today then likely will look back more on how he's done when it comes to the economy. And, you know, the administration is quick to point out that they came into a very bad situation and things are growing slowly now, but they're growing and they're better than they were. How do you think he has done as a president and the economy?
I think that's a great question. I suspect that this speech is going to have a lot of bragging about the recent macroeconomic progress, you know, falling unemployment rate. People are starting to come back into the labor force. I'd say I have a more mixed opinion. I think that he handled the recession fairly well. But I think a lot of Americans, if you went out and asked them on the street, they'd probably say that they don't feel like the economy is fully recovered. And so, you know, I'm interested to see how he's going to talk about that tonight.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, he's got some numbers that he can point to and some successes, but I think there was an NBC poll out this week that said 7 in 10 Americans think the country's headed in the wrong direction. Someone's got to be right and someone's got to be wrong, correct?
Yeah, I mean, as an academic economist, I think this is an ongoing puzzle. I mean, a lot of the numbers look good, but when you ask people, they're telling us something different. And, you know, I wish I had an answer to the question. I think there's other numbers out there that we haven't uncovered yet.
Well, I wonder then, as an economist, which is more important, the actual statistics or the sentiment? Because sentiment is pretty important.
Oh, no, I think you have to look at both of them for sure.
The House Republican Whip Steve Scalise was on WGN earlier this morning. He was talking to Steve Cochran and, you know, giving the Republican preview of the State of the Union. And he was talking also about the bill that the president vetoed, I think it was earlier this week, that would have repealed the Health Care Reform Act. Scalise said that the health care overhaul, the Obamacare law, has been a big job killer in this country. You look at health care and jobs. Is he correct? Has it been a job killer?
That's another great question. I think it's a little too early to say. There's some early research out that suggests hasn't been much of an effect on employment. But, you know, the way that I think about that is I think some of the things that we think could lead to reduced employment, such as employers facing the coverage mandate, haven't actually gone into full force yet. So, you know, if Obamacare is going to have a big effect on employment, you may see it down the line rather than in the last year or so.
And that's one of the things he could bring up tonight, right? The employee mandate or the employer mandate?
Yeah, I'm anxious to see how he talks about the healthcare reform. I mean, I'm pretty sure that he's going to note that there have been big reductions in the number of Americans that are uninsured. Costs seem to be staying under control, perhaps somewhat surprisingly. But you know, the two parts that I'm interested to see him going to talk about is how he's thinking about continuing to keep costs under control and how he's going to think about requiring firms to provide their workers with health insurance.
And where are we with this Cadillac tax? I know that's been bandied about, but I'm not even sure where exactly we are in that situation now.
Yeah, that's a good question. So my understanding is it's something that people just keep kicking down the road. So one of the features of the Affordable Care Act was to impose high taxes on extremely generous health insurance plans. But that was supposed to go into effect and just keep getting delayed. And I would say if you surveyed health economists, many of them would think this is one of the most important parts of the Affordable Care Act to keep health care costs under control.
The Cadillac tax.
When Congress gets serious. Yes, that's correct.
Right.
At some point, they get serious.
Well, I don't think we can count on the Congress to be serious, do you?
I'm always optimistic.
Does the president give credit, or does he deserve credit? He takes credit for saving the auto industry in this country.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think he can arguably take some of the credit, but you know, a lot of the economic recovery, I don't think the president should be taking most of the credit for that.
I want to.
It's not primarily policy driven.
It is not primary policy driven.
Yeah, that would be my reaction.
Okay, well, your reaction is better than mine. You're the expert on this, I think. So, I'll go with what you say. I want to ask you too about the State of the Union, and one area where there might be a bit of consensus, and I'm interested if you see an economic impact on this, but one area where there's some consensus seems to be in some form of criminal justice reform. You know, whether it's changing in sentencing guidelines, I know the president wants to go further than a lot of Republicans do, but there are Republicans who want to sort of change the way we incarcerate people and the lengths of time. So given that, if they can agree on that, does that have a net plus or minus when it would come to the U.S. economy?
That's really interesting. I mean, I'm not that familiar with a lot of the research on incarceration policy, but certainly giving ways to get people who are released from prison back into the labor market, my best guess is that would have a positive effect on the labor market overall, because bringing them into the economy, into the labor force, in a job, if you then spend the income from those jobs, yeah, that would be my best guess, but yeah. I don't have a lot of confidence.
I feel for those guys who have a record and try to turn things around, and I know Danny Davis here in Chicago has worked on this, but who can never get hired again because, you know, employers, and there have been changes in that, but employers just won't hire an ex-felon. I understand it from the employer's point of view, but it's tough to turn your life around. You wrote a paper, I don't know if it was last year, about the housing boom and its relationship to the number of students who go to college, which kind of fascinated me. So the idea is that the better the housing market was in the 90s, the fewer people were going to college. That's kind of hard for me to sort out. Explain that for me.
Yeah, sure. This is a paper we recently released where we looked across different cities in the United States. So the housing boom, as you pointed out, was in the late 90s, early 2000s, but different cities felt the housing boom very differently. And so what we did is we looked at places that had really big booms, and what we found, you know, perhaps somewhat surprisingly, is the places that had really big booms, we actually saw decreases in their college attendance and college enrollment, particularly for two-year colleges, junior colleges, community colleges, things like that. And, you know, it's a little surprising. On the other hand, it's consistent with a lot of work in economics that when the local labor market conditions are really good, there's a fair number of people who decide it's just not worth it going to college. So this has been documented in the past for when there was a coal boom in the 1980s, when there was an oil price boom. So I think it's housing boom is kind of similar to that. And so I think that's the best way to think about it.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me because we were talking just earlier about oil prices and how oil prices are going down. And so with the lower gas price, people are buying gas guzzling cars again as if it's going to last forever. Maybe that's the same thing when it comes to so the housing market's good, so jobs are good, things are plentiful. Well, so there's no need to go to college. I mean, it doesn't make sense that people aren't thinking beyond 4 or 5 years.
I think it's a great way to say it. I mean, just like the oil boom and coal boom of the past, during the housing boom, I think a lot of people did think that it was going to last forever. Certainly, the banks did, by the way that they were behaving. And so, you know, I think to cut some of the young adults some slack, if you really think it's going to last forever, then maybe the sectors that are booming when the housing market is booming look like a pretty good deal for you. You know, unfortunately, after 4 or 5 years, the boom turns into a bust. And our you know, I think the end of our paper, one of the perhaps sad results is that a lot of the individuals that didn't go to college during the boom don't seem to go back to college during the bust. And so for that generation, it looks like they might have lower college attendance rates, you know, for potentially a very long time.
Right, because they probably lost the window, or they think the window on that college education is closed.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Is there a time when college education, the numbers soar?
Well, you know, one thing we learned about working on this paper is that college attendance often does soar anytime that there's a negative macroeconomic shock. So during recessions, for example, a lot of people decide to either return to college, go to college, stay in college longer, less likely to drop out of college. So, you know, in bad times, often college is a place to kind of suck people up while they're having trouble finding jobs. But then if you take that and flip it around, that means when jobs are plentiful, there might be some people who decide that it's not worth it to go to college.
Wow, that's something to think about. So in tough times, college enrollment goes up. Maybe because people have nowhere else to go. And in good times, people think they're not going to need a college education, so they don't go. Something to think about. Matt Notowadigdo from Northwestern University, Associate Professor of Economics. It was great to talk to you today. Thank you very much for your help on this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, so make a big bowl of popcorn, watch the State of the Union address, and see how we did.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Twelve fifty-two. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. The U.S. beauty industry's got about, a million people who are doing your nails, cutting your hair, things like that. A median annual wage of about $23,000. They often earn less than half of what you pay for the haircut. And you've got to go to them and you've got to make a schedule and all of that. Well, there's a plan to change that. It's called Lisa, the app Lisa. And the founder and CEO is named Robert Richmond. He joins us now on a phone line. Robert, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, guys.
All right. So what's this about? Is this about convenience for the client who can use this app and get a haircut or manicure anytime, anywhere? Or is this about the person giving the manicure and the haircut and securing that they get a better share of the money that's paid for the services?
Well, that's actually a great question. And the answer is this was a company that was built by the artists for the artists. So, you know, our first priority and concern is to stabilize the artists as entrepreneurs within their own industry, where they can really control their own destiny, build a business that works for them. So, you know, what's great about that is it also gives the clients freedom and flexibility as well to get services when they want, where they want, at the price they want.
Right.
As well.
And you know what, Robert, maybe that should have been my second question. My first question should have been, tell me about this Lisa app and what it is. How does a client use it?
So the Lisa app is the first mobile application that will match consumers to beauty service providers, whom we call artists. It allows them to book services in real time through geolocation technology or for future appointments. They can work with their existing artists that they're already comfortable with or find new artists on the platform that matches what they're looking to spend and where they're looking to get the service. So, to you know, a use case would be, I'm sitting at home on Sunday, I'm watching the playoff football games, and I decide I want a barber to, I need a haircut. So I can get on the app, I can search for barbers that are live in my area, and I can then go ahead and book that barber, and they'll be at my door within 30 minutes, or within 1 hour.
So they will come to you.
They will come to me at my home, at my office, or wherever I'm at, wherever my geolocation is. If I'm at my friend Jim's house, I can call, you know, an artist over there as well. But if I'm a client that decides, you know what, I don't just want an at-home service, I'd rather not get it at home, I want to go to a salon or a barbershop or a spa, I can search for artists that are only working out of their location as well.
And so when they do that, then we're talking a little bit again about the share that the barber gets, right? Because if you're going to a salon or a barbershop, they might not get the full cut. No pun intended.
Well, here, no pun taken. So, you know, I actually use that a lot. I say the beauty of, and I don't mean to, right, but it happens. But, you know, no, there's different scenarios for salons and barbershops and spas. There's scenarios where they are an independent contractor working at that salon or spa, and that salon or spa is taking anywhere between 40 to 60% per transaction. And then there's scenarios where artists go out and rent booth space from a salon, barbershop, or spa. So they pay a certain set amount of money per day or per week, and then they keep 100% of the revenue coming in after they pay that barbershop or spa or salon.
All right, so
say it's $150 or $200 a week for the barber chair. The barbershop doesn't take any of that money outside of the $200 that they're paying for that leased space.
All right, I get my hair cut at Otero's, and Elias Otero is the guy who runs the place. He better be listening. He probably isn't, but if he is, he's thinking, wait a minute, I run this shop. The lease app is going to try to put me out of business. Are you going to try to put him out of business?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer is no. We're trying to stabilize the business for the artist. I mean, the bottom line is, these artists are earning $23,000 a year in a $100 billion a year industry. And something needs to be changed. And what needs to be changed is, you know, technology. Technology has finally caught up with this industry. And whether it's us or somebody else, technology is definitely going to stabilize the artists within this industry. So as far as your friend who owns that salon, at first, he or she might be a little bit nervous that Lisa is coming to market. But we actually have an incredible solution for the spas, salons, and barbershops, which we'll be rolling out very shortly after the launch of Lisa. So we're going to be able to, we know, for instance, that the average salon sits with about 38% of their booths empty every single day. In fact, if you're to walk down the street and just look in most spas or salons, you're going to see that there's a lot of empty chairs in there. But guess what we have? We have mobile artists now that need spaces to work out. So we're going to be able to, have those artists book that vacant space. And it really becomes a real estate play for a lot of these owners of these salons and spas and barbershops, because they're sitting with empty space. And we have artists that want to rent it.
That's Robert Richmond, the founder and CEO of the Lisa app. Robert, thanks very much for coming on the show today and explaining that. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, guys. I appreciate being on.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.